With our very special guest tonight, Kevin Randall. His website, by the way, is linked up now at coasttocoastam.com. His latest work, Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky. We'll be back with more with Kevin in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin, when you do your research, how do you go back hundreds, maybe even thousands of years? How do you find that kind of information and data?
You have to be very careful. You spend a lot of time in archives.
Absolutely.
Looking at old manuscripts, looking at old newspapers, looking at translations of various old documents. But you can also take a look. I mean, there's a UFO sighting in the Bible. If you take one of the interpretations of Ezekiel and he saw the wheel, which it turns out Ezekiel had been a Israeli prophet who had been captured and taken to Babylon. And in 2003, I had an opportunity to tour Babylon. So I got to see the palace where Daniel saw the handwriting on the wall and all of that stuff. So you just have to take a look at what has gone on, the interpretations of things. And you have to remember that the people in that era were describing what they saw in the words and the terms of that era. So when a Roman historian, for example, talks about a fiery shield in the sky, that could be interpreted as a disc-shaped object flashing across the sky, but it could also be a meteor or something else, something that they may not have understood. So you have to take a look at all of that and try to be very careful in your interpretation of these ancient writings.
Well, Neil, that's true too. Well, let's go back to this 840 AD event in France. Tell me about that.
This was actually was talked about in a number of different books. Brad Steiger has a couple of interpretations in two or three of his books of these people who were about to be stoned to death or were stoned or going to be executed. And they talked about having cloud ships, and they'd come down in the cloud ships. And this may be one of the first UFO crashes. A cloud ship, of course, could be interpreted as some kind of an alien spacecraft, a ship that travels in the clouds as opposed to something on the ground. It also could be interpreted as something with huge white sails on it, but you would think in 840 France, they would be familiar with ships with sails. The execution was stopped by the local religious leaders, and the people were supposedly engaging in some kind of commerce with the locals, which makes it kind of interesting and makes you wonder about sort of some things like that. But it's an event that's appeared in a number of different UFO books with a suggestion that this was some kind of a UFO crash. So I thought to begin the book, we'd start with something like that and move forward from 840 AD, even though there were other events earlier than that. There was something from around 2000, around zero, I suppose, the year zero, about 2,000 years ago, that came out of New Mexico and some of the hieroglyphs and the petroglyphs there that suggest something might have crashed. But that interpretation to me was a little bit shaky, so I wanted to get something that was a little bit more modern and something that we could kind of get into. There's a second case that follows that one also around that time, so maybe a few years later, that sounds suspiciously like ball lightning, something that we've only recently come to understand, where something crashed through the window of a castle and kind of bounced around on the inside. Sounds suspiciously like ball lightning, but I thought it was important to bring that forward because it had been discussed in some UFO books as a UFO event. I'm not sure that it is.
Back in then 1862, there's one near the Indian Ocean. You remember that one?
Well, yes, a number. I think it was a guy from Houston had talked to a reporter there and talked about how they had been shipwrecked and saw this huge thing crash into a cliff. And they went up there and there were giant corpses, giant-sized individuals involved in that thing. And it drove a couple of the people crazy. One guy committed suicide. But this was an era where newspapers tended to take everything and print it, regardless of the source, and they weren't above making up some stuff if it was a really, really slow news day. So I you know, that one sounds suspiciously like some guy telling a tall tale and the reporter overhearing it says, yeah, I'll write that down and we'll run with that. There's also one from Nebraska in I think it's 1882 that sounds like a UFO crash and they couldn't get close to it because the wreckage was so hot and they found little tiny gears and things like that Jerry Clark again was involved in investigating through the newspapers, and that was how we found some of this stuff. You go back and you read the old newspapers at the time, and you find some very interesting things in those newspapers.
Do you remember the case? I think it was New Guinea, where a flying ship was observed by some kind of a minister and his flock.
That was Dr. Gill. And it was Papua New Guinea.
And the creatures were waving back or something?
They seemed to be standing on some kind of an outside deck, and they communicated by waving at one another. I know Hynek was very impressed with that case, given the credibility of Father Gill. So mm-hmm. Hynek really liked that case.
I mean, what could that have been, Keith?
You know, there are a number of cases, and I think of the McMinnville photographs in this as well, where there are two possible explanations. It's a hoax or it's extraterrestrial. There's no middle ground. And I know that a lot of the skeptics and the debunkers say, well, there is no interstellar travel. They can't get here from there. Therefore, anything like that must be a hoax. On the other side of the coin, if you accept the idea of interstellar flight, then these cases could certainly be real. So Father Gill either observed a craft with the creatures on it, waving at him, or he made the whole thing up for some bizarre reason.
Or he made it up. But what are the odds of that?
I don't think it's very good. I think he observed something.
Something strange.
Something very strange and reported as accurately as he could exactly what he had seen.
Did they have flying craft, balloons at that time? Dirigibles?
Well, back in the first observation of enemy maneuvers was during the Civil War, and George Custer, yeah, that guy, again, we get to Custer, made a number of ascents in the balloons and would write down what he saw and then communicate it to the Union forces on the ground. So that's like the first aerial observation. And when I was in flight school, we had a guy named Merkel who just was fascinated by Custer and tried to get Custer awarded the Army Aviator's Badge because he was one of the first people to go aloft and do a military mission. And given Custer's history, I'm hoping he failed in his mission to get Custer an aviator's badge.
When I got a hold of Leonard Stringfield, it was to get information about that Cape Girardeau, Missouri crash, because I was in St. Louis at the time, and he had done some work on that. That was a bizarre one. I was trying to find the sheriff, who was long since gone, who was one of those involved in that case. Did you look at that one?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Communicated with Charlotte Mann, who was the main witness in the case. It was her grandfather, who was a minister, who was called out at night to some kind of a crash, and he described beings that was clearly not human. And there's a little bit of uncertainty of whether or not one was alive when he got there or all of them were dead, but he prayed over them and that sort of thing. Then he was taken home by the sheriff and told his family what he'd seen. And sometime later, a photograph surfaced of this that Charlotte Mann saw of the aliens. And Lynn Stringfield thought from her description it may be one of those photographs that circulated on the internet or has been circulated on the internet. But he sent her a copy of the photograph. She said, no, the one she saw was different. Her sister has corroborated her story, and I think it's the brother of the sheriff who remembers something about it as well. So Charlotte Mann is the main witness talking about this event that took place in Cape Girardeau. Clearly the beings were not human. She gives a good description of that. I know that Len was very impressed with that case. The only trouble I have with this case is that it took place in 1941.
Yeah.
If that is true, then the military was aware of the possibility of another alien craft crashing. And it seems to me that their response at Roswell would have been a lot different if they'd been forewarned in that way. But I suppose we can look at compartmentalization, and the word didn't get filtered down as quickly as it should have, and so they reacted inappropriately at Roswell. Charlotte Mann seems to be a very sincere woman, trying to relate as accurately as she can what she remembers of a family history and a family tradition. And I know Len was very impressed with that case.
You know, I'm just wondering if you were to, you know, come upon a crash site of something, some object, whatever it is, if it would look like it was from this planet, if it would look like it was extraterrestrial, you know, it depends on the impact. I mean, look at the controversy surrounding the plane that crashed into the Pentagon during 9/11, where they really can't find a lot of debris at all. So I guess it's very possible if something crashes under that kind of magnitude, there's not a lot left, is there?
Again, it depends. It depends on a lot of the circumstances. At Roswell, there was a lot left, but the government had the resources, which would be the soldiers stationed at the Roswell Army Airfield, to get out there and pick it all up. I mean, they had the manpower to do it. Roswell was an isolated area as well, so you didn't have a lot of people coming and going to Roswell. If the event at Roswell had happened, say, outside New York City or Los Angeles, I don't think the military and the government could have controlled it the way it did. But it happened in a very isolated location. And even today, Roswell, although there's 50,000 people living in Roswell, it's still 3 hours to El Paso. It's 3 hours to Albuquerque.
It's out there.
It's out there by itself. It's hard to get to. There's no interstate highway to it. You have to take Mesa Airlines, for crying out loud, from Albuquerque to Roswell. So it's a very isolated area. So in that circumstance, even if there's a lot left, they were able to recover it. In today's world, if we were to come across something like that, I think our reactions would be a lot different than it would have been in 1947, especially when you remember that this was just after World War II. Everybody was very security conscious. Everybody was thinking along those lines. And if the government asked you to do something, you pretty much did it. In today's world, if you asked...
And you believed your government.
Yes. And in today's world, if the government said to a reporter, we'd like you to sit on the story, they're liable to say, screw you, and here... And the next thing you know, CNN and Fox News and MSNBC and CBS and everybody is publishing that story.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. You make reference about a J. Edgar Hoover letter. Tell me about that.
While we were doing the Roswell investigation, this letter surfaced. Clyde Colson, I think, was the number two man in the FBI, and they were asked to investigate UFO sightings in some fashion, apply the FBI expertise to interviewing witnesses and things like that. About this time, there was an event that took place or some kind of a crash, and Hoover wrote on this memo where Tolson says, yeah, we ought to do this. Hoover said, you know, we would have to get full cooperation from the Army. There's two letters there, two numbers or two symbols there that are hard to read, but it looks like it says Southwest case. The Army grabbed it and wouldn't let anybody see it. Well, looking at that, I found another document where that paragraph was typed out by a secretary, and it says the L.A. case. It looks pretty much like L.A., which would be the abbreviation for Louisiana. And that fits with a case that took place in Shreveport at the beginning of the UFO phenomena in the early July, where somebody had thrown I think it's an 18-inch disc over a wall, kind of to fool somebody. So you've got the Army, and then this time it would be the Army Air Force, of course, Army investigating this thing, and the Army picked up the device and took it to Barksdale Air Force Base or Barksdale Army Airfield at the time. But the FBI knew about it, and the FBI was involved in it. So that kind of makes you wonder about this. But I'm pretty sure that the solution to the Hoover memo is the Shreveport, Louisiana case. But I could be wrong on that one.
Why do these objects, Kevin, if they are, why are they crashing? What the heck's wrong with them?
Well, First of all, you have to remember there aren't that many that are crashing. The numbers of crashes, I think we could whittle down quite a bit. But if you get a lot of things going on, if you've got a lot of hours in a UFO, if you will, somebody's bound to make a mistake, push the wrong button, fall asleep at the switch, and there's a catastrophic failure and there's a crash. Not in the numbers that are being reported, but somebody, some alien creature, they're obviously not perfect. We have yet to invent a machine that's perfect, although I have to admit that the reliability of our cars are a lot better than they used to be. The reliability of your computer is probably a lot better than it used to be. I'm not so sure about the power here at home because I think, as you know, like 3 minutes before I'm to go on the air, we lose all our power, and I'm scrambling to get a phone that'll work. We got you. Yeah, and the power came on about 8 minutes after we started everything, so it worked out okay. But so mistakes happen, and things break. I've also wondered about this as well, and I've postulated this a few times, and it's strictly speculation. But if I was an alien species and I wanted to present myself in the most benign way, non-threatening way I could think of, why not crash one of my craft and let the beings on the other world get a chance to look at it and get a chance to look at what we look like so that they'll be more comfortable when we finally show up? And of course, their plan was thwarted by a government that hid all the information, so they just went away. But I mean, that's always a possibility. It's some kind of a larger plan on the part of the aliens
to
introduce themselves.
It could be. You know, I've always thought that these were craft that probably had come from some mothership, and that something just went wrong with them.
Yeah, you know, it seems, based on the debris, based on the descriptions we have, that's probably a much more likely explanation than what crashed was an interstellar ship.
Exactly.
It came from something else. It did not have the armor or the capability. I guess it would be akin to an aircraft carrier.
Like a little shuttle.
Yeah, it's very hard to break an aircraft carrier, but the aircraft that you launch from it are much more fragile.
There never seems, though, to be a rescue mission. How come?
There was discussion and sightings in New Mexico after this specific one where they talked about craft close to the ground with searchlights playing on it in the days that followed the event at Roswell. On the other cases, Cape Girardeau for one, because you brought that up, the Las Vegas case, the Kexford case, there doesn't seem to be a rescue. Shag Harbor, on the other hand, it seems that the thing fell into the water. A second object joined them, and a week, 10 days later, both objects were seen, or both objects left the area.
Underwater, and then off they went.
Took off. So that might have been a rescue scene. It may be that once the crash crashed and they know there's no survivors, they don't care. Screw it.
And if they're robots, they probably don't care at all.
And that thought had crossed my mind too. I was thinking more of a cybernetic creation, some kind of an artificial creation, more
disposable,
but a little bit smarter than a robot.
Kevin, let's spend the rest of the half hour talking about some late information you've got about Roswell, and then next hour we'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, with Kevin Randall, we'll take phone calls with Kevin next hour. Hey, are you a Streamlink member yet? Well, you can be for just pennies a day, and you'll get your downloads, archives, podcasting, iPhone apps, soon to be Android apps, who knows how many other apps after that. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. Kevin Roswell, let's get into this. This was your biggie, and it still is, and you've got some information in Crash that I haven't seen anyplace else. Tell me what's going on there.
What happened is Carl Flock had decided that the Frankie Rowe testimony, Frankie Rowe was the daughter of a firefighter in Roswell in 1947, and he told his family about having been involved in this thing and what he had seen. Well, Carl Flock talked to three firefighters in Roswell and said, never happened. The fire department didn't make runs outside the city limits. These guys said they knew nothing about it. It never happened. Turns out the guy's still alive, and I had an opportunity to talk to him a year and a half ago, something like that. And we're talking about this. I discovered by going through the records at the fire department, they did in fact make runs outside the city limits. So that criticism didn't work. But I was talking to this firefighter, and he was telling me basically the same thing that he had told Carl Flock. Well, we didn't go out there. There was no run out there. Nothing happened like that. And I said, well, did you know Dan Dwyer, who was Frankie's father, of course? And he said, oh, yeah, he knew Dan. And Dan had gone out there on his own. And I'm thinking, what? What are you talking about? Turns out, according to this firefighter, interviewed by Carl Flock, and I don't think Carl asked him the right question. I think Carl got the information he wanted and gave up on it. I asked the one more question, which was, did you know Dan Dwyer? So the guy tells me that a colonel from the base, and I've always wondered why everybody that came out from the base was a colonel. They didn't send any captains out or lieutenants, but that's irrelevant. But this officer from the base came out and told him that they had it covered. Don't worry about it. You didn't have to send anybody out there. Don't go. Dan Dwyer got in his personal car and went out there. So, of course, there's no record of a fire run because the fire department didn't make a run out there. Dwyer went out by himself in the personal car. The guy confirms it. Says, yeah, Dwyer came back and told him a little bit about what he'd seen. So the real point is that the fire department was tangentially involved. Yes, Dan Dwyer went out there and saw the alien creatures and saw part of the crash craft. This guy knew it, but the fire department had been told not to go out there. So we were able to take the story a little bit further and refute one of the skeptic claims that Frankie Rowe wasn't telling the truth. I've always thought Frankie Rowe was telling the truth as best she could, which is not the same thing as meaning that it was based in reality, but I think her story was based in reality. Her sister, Helen Cahill, had confirmed it for me many, many years ago. We could find some information that suggested what Frankie Rowe was telling us about the look of the alien creature and what her father had told her was accurate. So it's just one more example of a witness to the Roswell case we've been able to revitalize and corroborate part of the story.
What did you think of Frank Kaufman? I had a chance to interview him back in 96. He told me a story of how he and several others, and I believe he was in the military, came across what he said was a crashed saucer. He saw that. Stanton Friedman doesn't believe him, and of course Kaufman has passed on. What do you think of him?
Well, Kaufman was a witness I found.
Oh, was he? Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm the first one to talk to him. I got to him through Walter Hott. Walter Hott told me, Crane Kaufman's somebody you should talk to.
One of our guys, right?
Yes. And so I called Frank and told him a little bit about who I was and what was going on and said, I understand you know something about this crash. And he says, well, I don't know, which was his standard answer. But and as you know, he told a marvelous story.
A great story. Very detailed.
The problem is, after he passed on, Mark Rodiger, Don Schmidt, I think Mark Chesney from the center were down in Roswell, and Juanita, his wife, asked them to take a look at Frank's papers to make sure that all his contractual obligations had been met so that she wasn't holding the bag on something.
Sure.
And going through his papers, they discovered that the document he'd shown us about his military separation and what he'd been trained to do and his rank in the military had been forged. Turned out he wasn't a master sergeant as he claimed. He was a staff sergeant.
But he was still there, right?
He was in Roswell in 1947, but he was a civilian at the time. He worked in personnel. His training was all in administration. There was absolutely nothing to suggest any training in
field work.
In intelligence.
Yeah.
And given what we were able to determine, and I say we, although it really falls at the hands of Mark Rodiger and Don Schmidt and Mark Chesney, even I now don't believe Frank Kaufman was telling the truth.
Ah, okay.
And it's very unfortunate because that sort of thing And I was one of the leading proponents, of course, the Frank Kaufman story. But that sort of thing, it taints everything that we do.
It does. Why would he do this?
There was
no, I don't see any monetary gain, do you?
Oh, yes, there was.
Huge?
Not necessarily huge. I know at one point Japanese film crew was in Roswell. Tom Carey was there. I was there. A number of people, but the Japanese paid a number of the witnesses $1,000 each. So there was a monetary gain. But there was also the spotlight. I mean, he got to be on Coast to Coast.
He got to be on Coast to Coast.
He got to be on a lot of different television programs. Yeah. I saw him on Good Morning America or the Today Show. I think it was Good Morning America. Saw him on Good Morning America. So he got an opportunity to be on television that he would never have had before. And that's a very powerful draw to some people.
So here's a guy who gets involved in what many of you say is one of the most incredible UFO cases ever and distorts it.
And undermines the credibility of it. There are a number of witnesses that we all had accepted, or some of us had accepted. Gerald Anderson also springs to mind, who was out on the plains of San Augustine and tells this marvelous story about having come across the craft and seeing the alien creatures and all of that. But the story breaks down because of other things that he had done. He created a phone bill. I'd interviewed Gerald Anderson before Stan actually talked to him. And I talked to him for like 56 minutes on the telephone. I had a tape of it. And Anderson said, well, you know, I only talked to Randall for 26 minutes and I didn't really like him. And we were able to get the phone bill and prove that Anderson had forged a copy of the phone bill to make me look bad. I mean, why do that?
Yeah. Tell me about two things. Tell me about Walter Hout, the military public information officer, and his affidavit when he died.
Walter clearly was who he said he was. Clearly he was at Roswell in 1947. Clearly he was the public information
officer. Sent out that press release, right?
Sent out the press release. He's mentioned in the newspaper stories. I mean, clearly he was involved. No question about it. A very nice man. Enjoyed his role as Mr. UFO in Roswell. If you showed up at his door, regardless of the time, regardless of the day, he and his wife, Pete, were always willing to say hello and chat with you about it. And she would have you sign a little visitor's log so they could go back and show who all had been to visit with him and that sort of thing. So Walter Hout was a very nice man, clearly who he said he was. Got out of the service in 48, I believe, because they were going to transfer him out of Roswell. And they liked the town. Their daughters had been born there. They wanted to stay in the town, so he got off active duty so they could stay in Roswell. I don't know how many times I talked to him, how many times I was in his house, how many times we went to dinner. Was there with Don Schmidt a number of times. Was there with Stan Friedman a number of times. Always trying to get Walter to tell us a little bit more of what was going on. So Walter, as he got older and I guess sicker, decided to provide information about the Roswell case to be released after his death. And his story talks about the aliens, talks about the craft, sort of corroborates everything that we had found from other sources.
Why would he lie about it, right?
At that point, I don't know. There's an interesting corroboration, though. I met a fellow named Harris, who had been an assistant finance officer in Roswell in 1947. Who told me, and this was before Walter came out and told everybody about all the other stuff, told me that he had been talking to Walter, and Walter says, it's right on the other side of the door if you want to take a look. And this guy, Harris, tells me. So I took a hold of the doorknob, but he didn't open the door. I didn't want to get involved. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to see this thing. But what that does is corroborate part of what Walter Hout had said, by somebody who died, I think, in 97. So it was long before the affidavit that Walter Hout had prepared. And I say had prepared, Don. I think Don Schmidt actually prepared the affidavit for Walter's signature. But it corroborates part of what Walter was saying about being more deeply involved in this case. And if Walter was who he said he was, the public affairs officer and sort of a an unofficial aide to Colonel Blanchard, remembering in the military structure that colonels aren't authorized aides, general officers are. So Walter functioned as Blanchard's aide, although Blanchard was not authorized an aide. So he had a close relationship with the commander of the 509th Bomb Group. And what Harris tells me kind of corroborates part of that and makes the Walter story that much stronger.
What about the mortician Glenn Dennis?
Oh, that's a hard one because I know that there's a lot of people accept what he says, but and he told us the name of the nurse.
Who is dead, right? Naomi Marie.
Well, Naomi. He told me Naomi Self. He didn't say Marie. He told Carl Flock Naomi Marie Self. He told me, and when I say me, I mean Don Schmidt and me. Her name was Naomi Self, and had us looking for her.
But I think he admitted later it was a false name, right?
Yes, but see that's what bothers me about this because I was talking to him one day and he was kind of castigating me for not finding his nurse. He said, "I gave you the name. Why can't you find her?
You can't find someone that."
I said, "Well, I found four women named Naomi Self. They're not the right people."
Yeah.
And I said, "We've been looking for a guy named Robert Slusher." And I just talked to a guy named Robert Slusher in Tennessee who had been a pilot during World War II, but it wasn't the guy we were looking for. And Glenn Dennis says, "Oh, I know Bob Slusher. He lives over in Alamogordo." And I called the guy in Alamogordo, and that was the right guy. I was the guy I'd been looking for. But the point is, Glenn was saying, "Why haven't you found my nurse? I gave you the name." When we come back to him and say, you know, we can't find a nurse, an Army nurse, by this name in any of the records. We've been to the VA, we've been to St. Louis, we've been everywhere. We can't find this woman anywhere. He says, "Well, I didn't tell you the right name." At that point, I began to wonder about the reliability of what Glenn Dennis was telling us.
That's disappointing.
And yes, it is disappointing, and I don't know.
He's still alive, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, he's up there, though.
Oh, he's got to be like 500 years old or something.
Yeah, he's way up there.
Yeah, but he seemed to be a nice fellow. Once again, Don Schmidt and I were making a trip to Roswell, and we couldn't find accommodations in Roswell. Something was going on, and all hotels were filled. And he owned part of the Wortley Hotel in Lincoln.
I thought for a moment you were going to say he had you sleep in a casket.
No, no. But he owned part of the Wortley Hotel, which was in Lincoln, of course, the great Lincoln County War and Billy the Kid and all of that nonsense. So we're staying in the Wortley Hotel, and there's no telephones. There's electricity. There's indoor plumbing. There's no televisions. But it was just a real nice, quiet place to be. And the next morning, we're up outside, and we're sitting on the porch, and we can hear people talking. We can't see them. We don't know where the hell they are. But it was just it was so quiet there, you could hear people talking quietly blocks away, and so a nice fellow, but you know the couple things about his story that just don't track, that don't make sense, that don't work.
So it seems to me that you have a lot of reliable witnesses in Roswell, and then you've got some others who just want the attention, maybe a little financial gain, and so they deviate stories, or they change them, or they lie.
Yes, and I've said for a number of years that if we relied specifically on the just the military witnesses, and we would be better off because that would eliminate some of the people that we've talked about. Most of those
right.
who are not telling the truth are the civilian witnesses.
Right. Except for Kaufman.
No, Kaufman at the time was a civilian witness.
At the time.
He had been, right. I think he'd been discharged from the military in 1946. So at the time this event took place, he was a civilian. So if we eliminate the civilian witnesses, and by doing so, we eliminate Frankie Rowe, we eliminate the firefighters, which is unfortunate, but we end up with a solid core of very believable and very credible witnesses. One of whom, and I should mention this, was Edwin Easley, who was a provost marshal, who told me that it was extraterrestrial. Here's a guy who was there, he was on Blanchard's staff, and he says, Well, he didn't say that. I asked him, are we following the right path? And he says, what do you mean? And I said, we think it's extraterrestrial. And he said, well, let me put it this way. That's not the wrong path. So here's a guy who was there, deeply involved, telling us basically it's extraterrestrial.
How would you have handled the Lonnie Zamora case, the police officer who's now dead from Socorro, New Mexico, a single witness case? Would you have listened to it because he was law enforcement?
Because he was law enforcement and there was physical evidence left on the site. And so we have, in essence, two chains of evidence going for us, the physical evidence and the eyewitness testimony. There were two guys from Dubuque, Iowa, who claimed to have been there at the same time, and their stories appeared in the Dubuque newspaper like two or three days after the Zamora story. I know there are people who reject that corroboration, but their stories seem to be accurate, seem to be good. But Zamora's law enforcement, so you presume some credibility there. Why would a police officer want to jeopardize his job by telling a cockamamie story about a flying saucer landing? It's the only case, and I think this is right, it's the only case in the Project Blue Book files where there's occupants involved, creatures from inside, that's labeled as unidentified. So the Air Force could not explain the case in the conventional. There has been some discussion recently in the last 4 or 5 months that this was a elaborate hoax perpetrated on Zamora by students at the school there, college there. I'm just not sure I buy that explanation at the moment. I need some better evidence that this was some kind of a hoax. But the Zamora case is very interesting. It's a landing as opposed to a crash, of course. But at the moment, I'm inclined to believe that Zamora saw something otherworldly, extraterrestrial.
Great story. Truly a great story. There's many great stories, and I guess, Kevin, it's your job to weed through them in order to bring us the best ones.
Well, I think that's the job of any serious researcher is to look at the stories and determine which ones are credible and which ones are not. And I know in the UFO community, Stan and I disagree on some cases, but we also agree on others. And I think our agreement on the Roswell case outweighs our disagreements on it. So we're all kind of looking for the answers. We're all kind of setting the bar of acceptability at different levels. Stan might accept something that I find a little bit questionable, and he might question something that I find reliable. So we're all looking for the answers and trying to get to the bottom line of what is going on.
Well, Kevin, when we come back, final hour with you, let's look for some phone calls now, perhaps stories and or questions. Kevin Randall, our special guest tonight, his book, Crash, When UFOs Fall from the Sky. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.